From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, March 1st, 2017. And on this day, the effort to keep the sub-minimum tipped wage in Maine is gaining support among Democrats. And we'll hear from one man who entered Maine as a refugee about what the vetting process is actually like. Those stories ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
School start times have been a hot topic lately, with arguments about sleep deprivation and adolescent brain development up against arguments about problems later start times could create in small school systems. Now, a bill that would give Maine high schools later start times is before the legislature's Education Committee. Brunswick Democratic Representative Matthia Dautry says studies show teens often don't get enough sleep because of the 7:30 a.m. start time of many high schools. She's proposing legislation that would delay the start of the academic day until 8:30 instead.
Research has shown that sleep deprivation in teens can cause some frightening side effects. Teens who are sleep-deprived have reduced academic performance. The more tired a teen is, the more their grades will slip.
The Maine Principals Association opposes the bill because of the disruption and cost for rural school districts. That's because in smaller districts, elementary and high school students often share the same buses and buildings. The MPA says it should be up to local school districts and not the state about what time to start the school day. The number of refugees, asylum seekers, and other foreign-born people who settled in Maine last year was the largest in recent years. And as President Donald Trump prepares a new effort to restrict immigration, possibly to include what he calls extreme vetting of refugees from some countries, we wanted to learn a little bit more about how refugees are screened and processed before being resettled. Fred Bever has the account of one refugee who came here this past September.
When Charles fled the ethnic violence that killed his parents in his native city of Bunia in the Democratic Republic of Congo, he was around 11 or 12 years old. He doesn't remember exactly. Now 20, Charles spent almost half his life in the teeming Changwali refugee camp in Uganda.
He was safe, and it's just not good. He was safe, but not good. It was very hard life.
He traveled with his aunt named Love and his grandmother, Cecile. It was a relief to get to the Uganda camp, he says, but it wasn't really a home.
Things were not that very good. Food, shelter, water. Shelter was sometimes, you're put in a room without a roof. So most of the nights we used to sleep when it's raining on us.
He's asked that we not use his last name due to continued concern about safety for himself and his family. Within the first 3 months, Charles says workers from the United Nations High Commission for Refugees interviewed him and his family separately for certification as refugees and as potential candidates for resettlement abroad. The UN only refers for resettlement a small percentage of the world's refugees, those it considers most vulnerable to war, violence, or other harms, and refugees themselves cannot make the applications. It's the UN's choice, based on the information they can confirm about the refugees. Charles says local UN staff sought the truth of his story, matching it to records from the Congo and cross-checking it against what his relatives and others told them about what happened there.
Where are you from? Where exactly you ran from? And what are the causes that made you run? For what reason did you run out of where you are? And whom were you living with? What happened to them? Where are they? How old are you? What happened? In what time? What date? What hours of the day did the circumstances that happened and all that? There are a lot of questions over and over again.
Charles says he was interviewed by the UN 3 times in the first 9 months. They took fingerprints and did medical checks as well, a process repeated at least once a year for 8 years. It wasn't until 2014 that the High Commission for Refugees decided to recommend him and his relatives for resettlement abroad. As with most international refugees processed through the UN, Charles had no say over what country he would be recommended to, and he says he didn't hold a preference as long as it was a safe place to build a new life. As he learned, it would be the U.S.
And they told us, if America accepts you, we'll have a lot more interviews for you, We will have a lot more paperwork for you. We will have a lot of fingerprints for you. We will have a lot of injections and all medical stuff for you. So get ready for it.
And Charles says that's exactly what happened as a U.S.-funded resettlement support center started up its own vetting regimen from scratch. That meant interagency screenings with Charles's biographical information reviewed and checked against databases kept by the National Terrorism Center, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and the State Departments. According to guidance originally put out by the administration of former President Obama and still available online, refugees from Syria go through several extra screens, and the information for all potential refugees is rechecked as databases are updated. If no evidence emerges that the applicant is a security risk, no connections to known bad actors, for example, or outstanding arrest warrants, the applicant is cleared for the next step, more interviews by the U.S. Customs and Immigration Services.
They told us, we've interviewed you, you've done everything, but we're not the one making decisions. It's made from the big people beyond us, the one who decide whether you'll be coming in or not.
Once the biographical information checked out, Charles says he and his family went through a new round of fingerprinting to be screened against various databases run by Homeland Security, the FBI, and the Department of Defense. Any doubts raised along the way can derail a refugee's admittance to the U.S., but for Charles, Love, and Cecile, there were never any red flags, and one day an agent delivered them a letter
saying that we've been accepted. After they've done all their reviews, and then we knew that we were going to America.
Late last summer, they arrived at JFK Airport, then headed to a place they'd never heard of, Maine. As with most refugees to the U.S., Charles's case was turned over to a non-governmental organization, in his case, Catholic Charities of Maine, which spokeswoman Judy Katzel says spends 3 months helping families adapt.
And then begin that process of learning how to get around, how to go shopping, what the money, the currency is, how to ride a bus, if there are English classes, you know, where people need to be enrolled. If there are young children, do they need to be enrolled in the school system? You know, I mean, our goal is to help refugees become self-sufficient within that 90-day window.
Later this week, Catholic Charities takes over all stateside administrative responsibility for refugees resettled in Maine, as the state will drop its share of those duties. Charles, meanwhile, has taken a job at Catholic Charities, and he plans to go back to school. His aunt and grandmother are taking English classes. In a year, they must apply for green cards, which will require a fresh security review. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And now, from immigration policy to state politics, nearly a dozen Democratic lawmakers in Augusta, and maybe more, are siding with Republican Governor Paula Page to restore the sub-minimum wage for workers who take tips. The Democrats say they're acting in support of workers who've seen their tips dry up after the passage of a minimum wage hike initiative this fall. Steve Missler has our story.
Nearly 420,000 Mainers voted to support raising the minimum wage in November, a solid majority of 55%. That kind of victory would seem to settle the matter, but it hasn't. At least for servers like Christine Morrison, who waits tables at Raleigh's Diner in Auburn. She says she's seen a 10% dip in tips since Question 4 became law. Her base wage has gone up, but...
So in all, they're tipping us less, but we need to make more. So it's a catch-22.
Waitress Tiffany Churchill at Happy Days Diner in Auburn says she's experiencing it too. Churchill, a single mom, says her tips have dropped by about 25%. She says customers are tipping less and seem confused about how much they make under the new law.
I think people think that our hourly went up more than it really did, and they're not compensating us the right amount for our services.
And Darren Doolin, the owner of Happy Days, says the higher minimum wage may force him to increase menu prices to offset pay raises for staff.
I think it's going to put me out of business, you know, small places like me out of business.
Question 4 eventually eliminates the sub-minimum wage. It's a contentious idea, even among Democrats, who were united about raising the minimum wage. Representative Brian Hubble is among at least 8 Democrats in the crosshairs of progressive groups like the AFL-CIO and the Maine People's Alliance because they support reinstating the sub-minimum wage. Hubble represents Bar Harbor, a tourist destination with an economy buoyed by restaurants and the workers who currently depend on tips to make a living. Last year, Hubble told a Mount Desert Islander that he supported Question 4, but he opposed eliminating the sub-minimum wage.
This is really a case where I'm hearing from the workers themselves that it's not that they're reflexively opposed to it, they're just really worried about it.
Worried, that is, about a pay cut. The sub-minimum wage used to be $3.75 an hour, when the regular minimum wage was $7.25. The sub-minimum wage is now $5, thanks to the passage of Question 4, and it's supposed to increase until it's equal to the regular minimum wage in 7 years, by then at least $12 an hour. That might seem like a decent raise, especially if tipped workers keep receiving tips, and Matt Schlobohm of the AFL-CIO says he believes that Democrats should not support any efforts to undo Question 4.
I think Democrats should not be in the business of lowering workers' wages and tampering with the referendum. Let's be very, very clear. What it does is lower workers' wages, and that's a bad idea.
Schlobohm says they deliberately included the sub-minimum wage repeal in Question 4. They cite federal data, estimating that Maine servers make just over $9 an hour with tips. And they say 7 other states have done away with the sub-minimum wage without catastrophic consequences. They say other reasons for rejecting a tipped wage economy, including studies showing female servers are more prone to sexual harassment by employers and the customers they rely on for tips.
We have an economy that's deeply out of balance where workers can't make ends meet, and we need to raise wages for all workers.
But correcting the economic imbalance appears to have a math problem. It may take only a handful of Democrats to reinstate the sub-minimum wage, a move supported by Republicans and Governor Paul LePage. There are several bills to reinstate the sub-minimum wage, which means the battle over its future will likely come to a head at the end of the legislative session. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for March 1st, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.